Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All that news about Greece and its debt? Oh yeah, it still matters, but it might be time to get smart on Italy, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 14th of October. Good to have you with us. It's another weekend, another crisis meeting on European debt. Yes, I know, it seems like this happens all the time, and we all probably know more about the Greeks and their problems than we'd care to. But the story today, surprisingly, isn't Greece. Just west, across the Ionian Sea in Italy, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has barely survived a vote of no confidence. Great news, one imagines, for Mr. Berlusconi. Whether or not it's good for Italy and the rest of Europe is open to debate, though. The BBC's David Willey is in Rome. Mr. Willey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to talk about Mr. Berlusconi's victory, or is it a hollow victory in the Parliament today?
Well, you tell me. We all know that the Italians are in some debt trouble. How bad is it, and what is this going to mean for them getting out of it?
The market is going to dictate how this plays out, because the story of Italy's public debt is pretty well known. But just to recap, it has one of the largest debts in the world of any nation state. It ran up a debt equivalent to 120% of GDP, which is very large indeed. And attempts by Mr. Berlusconi's predecessors to pay off this debt haven't done very well, and he has only just increased it. So there is a basic flaw in the Italian economy, which is that the servicing of this debt is going to be more and more costly.
Well, we've been hearing now for what seems like years that the Greeks are the real problem, and boy, when Greece goes under, it's going to be really ugly. How do you make people understand that this is not just another, oh, it's a European economy thing? I mean, Italy is a big, big economy with big, big problems.
Italy is the third largest economy in the European Union. It's a great exporter of machine tools, food. Many Italian products, high fashion products as well, do very well overseas. So Italy has quite a vibrant economy. It's a nation of 60 million people, about the same size as that of the United Kingdom. It's enjoyed a relative prosperity, I would say, in recent years.
Is the European Bailout Fund, the EFSF, equipped to deal with something as big as Italy?
Well, that is the problem. If Italian sovereign debt becomes unsustainable, we're in deep trouble, because the debts of various countries are held, are shared, and Italian banks are believed to be fairly exposed to Greek debt. And if the Greeks do default, as now seems very likely, this could set in motion a process whereby Italian banks get into trouble, and the confidence of investors in Italian government securities is going to wane. The Italians are going to have to pay more to service this debt, and this is going to become a very uncomfortable spiral of increased prices, which in the end are going to cause ordinary Italians a lot of trouble.
Well, so when you go out to the cafes in the evenings or the markets at lunchtime, what are ordinary Italians saying? I mean, we've heard lots about the Greeks, not so much about the Italians.
The Italians are pretty fed up with Mr. Berlusconi. They say he's more interested in his own business affairs and in his various women friends. The general impression here is that Mr. Berlusconi is in the twilight of his period of power, and that we shall shortly see his departure, although he himself insists that he's going to stay on in office as Prime Minister of Italy until his mandate expires in 2013.
David Willey is the BBC correspondent in Rome. David, thank you very much.
Thanks to you.
All right, let's go from national debt to personal debt. There was a report out from CardHub.com this morning. That's a website that compares credit cards, that had some interesting news in it. Just 3.5% of us are a month or more behind on our credit card payments. That's the lowest level that number's been at since 1994, and it poses kind of an interesting question. As banks crank up fees to make up for lost revenue and consumers cut back on debt overall, have we permanently changed our credit-seeking ways? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that story.
When the recession hit, the frugalista bug bit. We started paying down our credit card balances and avoided racking up new ones. And fewer people are now behind on their credit card bills. Bill Hardikoff of LowCards.com says that's partly because banks got burned by all the loose lending before the recession. Now they've tightened up their credit standards. Only people who already have good credit can even get a card from a bank.
They have decreased their financial risk. So it's very difficult to get a credit card today if you have average or poor credit scores.
And the credit card users left more often pay on time. Plus, says Bart Narder of bank research firm Celent, consumers are in no mood to risk racking up debt again or the interest that comes with it.
People are moving away from debt and setting aside money for a rainy day because they see the rainy days both in the past and perhaps in the future.
Question is this a permanent shift in American consumer behavior, a new frugalista normal? Maryland resident Amanda Graham says it is for her. She is 46, uses only a debit card, and kissed credit cards goodbye.
Debt is not for us. We like living within our means, and we like seeing that we have savings to deal with emergencies. Now, do I imagine that as soon as things ease up and they feel safe, people are going to start using credit again? Absolutely.
If the banks even give it to them. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
California residents woke up to some surprising news today. Blue Shield, one of the biggest insurance companies in the state, said it's going to be giving back $285 million to individual policyholders. That is, people who don't get insurance through their jobs. That comes on top of another big give back in June. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner explains why.
Patricia Passeretti already knows how she's going to spend her rebate check.
To replace my cell phone that just died.
I reached her on her mom's cell phone, coming out of yoga class. Passeretti is one of 2 million Blue Shield policyholders in California who buy their own insurance. She's unemployed, with decidedly mixed feelings about the rebate.
I mean, I'm grateful to have anything coming back to me, but at the same time, it almost feels like I'm paying too much anyway.
When people buy their own insurance, as opposed to buying it through an employer, premiums can be up to twice as expensive. That's because insurers set those premiums by guessing how much health care each person will use that year. J.B. Silvers of Case Western Reserve University says with Blue Shield,
well, they guess too high. If they'd guess too low, they'd have a big loss, so they're going to get some of it back.
Blue Shield promised to give back money to policyholders when its profits exceeded 2% of revenue. Rebates could become more common in the industry. The healthcare law sets a cap on insurance company profits and administrative expenses. Blue Shield, a nonprofit, may be doing what regulators will soon mandate, says Randy Boberg of the Urban Institute.
It is noticeable that they got out in front by voluntarily providing the rebate.
So why did Blue Shield guess wrong? Why did it take in premiums so much more than it paid out in claims? In part, it's the recession. People skimp on care in hard times. Patricia Passeretti says,
yes, I did. I tried to avoid going to the doctor because I can't afford it right now.
While other studies show that a recession makes people healthier. Remember, I caught her at yoga class. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
It was a good day and a good week on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We had a yes on free trade. We had a no on the jobs bill. We had Chinese currency, and Wall Street is still occupied. Just another week in the American economy, I guess. Here to help us wrap it up, we've got our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore with us. Also, Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg TV down in Washington. Hey, guys.
Hi. Hi.
So work with me on this one. I've got this theory, Lizzie, that says mainstream media was, in essence, shamed into covering the Wall Street protests. So far, so good?
I think that wouldn't be entirely inaccurate.
Okay,
yes.
So let's take it the next step farther. And since you're in Washington, when will politicians, even though they obviously know no shame, when will they be shamed into paying attention to what's going on?
Oh, I think they're already paying attention, in part because the media is, and in part because many of the media who are trying to cast Occupy Wall Street as an inverse of the Tea Party. I don't happen to think that's entirely accurate, but I get the narrative, and I think that Democrats have to deal with it. And the vice president talked about it.
Yeah. Heidi, what's your sense of what Wall Street thinks of Occupy Wall Street? I mean, when you talk to people.
Yeah, it's interesting because you've heard this idea, we are the 1%, we are the 99%. Right. And I think it's just the 100% from what I've heard, because as I've been talking to people in the putative 1% bankers, right, investment mm-hmm. bankers who make millions of dollars, they all sympathize with some aspect of what Occupy Wall Street is saying. I mean, they understand wealth inequality. They came from the middle class, most of them. And so what you see here is a rift between, you know, the middle class that made it and the middle class that didn't. Hmm. And there used to be class mobility, and obviously the recession has just robbed us all of that, right? You know,
yeah.
It's basically like musical chairs. You're stuck where you landed. And they understand the frustration, and they feel it themselves. I mean, even in places like Greenwich, Connecticut, there are unemployed bankers. Obviously, they have tremendous cushions. Don't play your violins for them. But you know, people everywhere are feeling this and understanding it. It's not just limited to you know, the middle class, or what you call the middle class.
Yeah. All right. So another question, I guess, for you, Lizzie O'Leary, down in Washington. It's today's the deadline for submissions to the super committee, that gang of 12 or whatever the heck it is that's going to decide our fate come the day before Thanksgiving on the budget. Is that actually going to go anywhere, or is Congress going to sort of change its mind as it is wont to do and say, no, this whole trigger thing isn't going to matter?
I think you may see Congress change the rules, not necessarily their mind. Look, when you go back and look at a lot of these plans that were submitted and what the super committee was talking about, the only stuff that they could ever agree on, even in some of the initial discussions, were cuts to non-defense discretionary spending. That's about 12% of the federal budget. That does not get you to $1.5 trillion. It doesn't get you to $1.2 trillion. It's just simply impossible. So you may see a couple of things move. You also may actually see that failed jobs bill get punted to the super committee. That's something that they were
really?
Talking about. Yeah,
oh,
yeah, that
man.
Was something Mitch McConnell talked about. Right, everything, everybody into the pool.
Oh my! How does that possibly work? We're gonna let these 12 legislators.
It doesn't work.
Oh God. Well, so Heidi, pick up on that thread for a minute and talk to me about how any of this works in a way that gets the economy moving again.
Well, I don't know if it works about the economy, but it certainly gets the super committee's bank accounts moving. They've been huge beneficiaries of corporate donations ever since they made it onto the super committee. So the issue is the economy is we need to replace jobs. We need to get industry moving in such a way that it's hiring people. And I think we also need to accept that none of that is going to happen before this crucial election. So everything that Congress is doing right now, I have to believe, is just kabuki.
And there is a split, Kai, that came up, I think, in the jobs report that we saw come out for September, where you actually did see some hiring pick up on the short-term end, but it's that long-term segment.
Right.
It's the people who've been unemployed for more than 6 months. That's not showing any movement.
And that from a woman who spends a lot more time with those jobs numbers than most of the rest of us. Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg Television down in Washington, and Heidi Moore in New York City for us. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So as I said, Wall Street is, as of this hour, still occupied after what you can only describe as a game of chicken early this morning at Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. The four-week-old protest that sits on some of the most expensive price per square foot land in the world has been allowed to continue. City Hall backed down on its promise to close the park for cleaning. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains, like everything else in real estate, what's going on boils down to location, location, and location.
Hundreds of people packed into Zuccotti Park this morning. Many of them live there, including 22-year-old Poncho Guthrie.
Most of the people who've realized that this is their home, they're keeping it very clean.
Guthrie has been able to stay here because Zuccotti Park is what's called a publicly owned private space. Since the 60s, New York has let developers exceed certain zoning limits in exchange for creating public plazas. Amanda Burden is the city's planning commissioner.
It gives an opportunity for a little green space in this very dense city.
There are more than 500 such spaces in New York, and it's a little unclear who calls the shots in them.
This is a legal gray area.
Gerald Caden is a professor of urban planning at Harvard. He says the city can't oust the protesters unless they break the law. Brookfield, the company that owns Zuccotti, has its hands tied a bit, too, because the space is public domain.
Ironically, Occupy Wall Street has greater rights in this privately owned public space than it would in a public park.
Which, among other things, would close at night. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, a journalist's worst nightmare.
A few months ago, I came face to face with my nemesis, software that can write news stories.
Yeah, but can it talk on the radio? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shot up 166 points today, added nearly 1.5%. The blue chips did, ended at 11,644. The NASDAQ up 47 points, 1.8%, 2667 at the close. The S&P 500 advanced 20 points, about 1.75%, ended things at 1224. For the week, and it was a good one, the Dow rose 4.9%. The NASDAQ lifted 7.6%. The S&P 500 gained 6% as well. Google powered up nearly 6% today. Yesterday, the search giant posted quarterly results that far exceeded analyst expectations. Apple packed on 3.33% today as that phone thing they've got going went on sale. Strong retail sales numbers pushed up department store shares. Macy's bagged more than 3%. Nordstrom wrapped up nearly 2.5% today. The price on the 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 2.25%, 2.25% the number. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its monthly industrial production report. President Obama begins a three-day bus tour traveling through North Carolina and Virginia. He'll talk about jobs and the economy. And the United Nations marks the International Day for the Eradication of Poverty. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. My, oh my, how far the gap has fallen. The once hip but still somehow ubiquitous retail brand is going to close a bunch of U.S. stores by the end of 2013. Too ubiquitous, it turns out. But it's also going to triple its business in China, becoming the latest big American company to look overseas for growth. Torsten Stocker is on the phone with us now from Hong Kong. He's with the Monitor Group over there. That's a consumer research firm. Torsten, good to have you with us.
Glad to be on the program.
So I was in Shanghai a number of months ago on a big reporting trip, and we actually went to a Gap store in a big mall in Shanghai, and two things hit me. One is that the place was completely empty. There was not a soul in sight. And the other one was they had basically taken an American Gap store and plopped it down in the middle of China. How does that work?
That's a very valid question, but I think the way they've entered China is obviously based on what they know best, and I think that's really maintaining the core values of their brand and being an American casual brand and having all those elements of Americana as part of their brand. And, of course, the big challenge is to get Chinese consumers hooked on that.
Yeah. One thing that caught me when I was there. So they've taken their premier line of jeans, the 1969 jeans, and they're selling them in China and branding them as 1969 jeans. And 1969 in China was not a great year, right? You had the Red Guards, and it was bad in the middle of the Cultural Revolution. Is that... Do Chinese consumers get that?
Some may, but I think the consumers that they're targeting now, I think, you know, mostly younger consumers born in the 80s and the 90s or maybe the 70s, you know, I don't think that they would actually make that connection to 1969 as that particular year. Now, of course, having said this, they might not make a connection to the 60s counterculture in the West either. So in that sense, it's probably more of a neutral, right, rather than a negative or a positive.
What about this idea that they're going to expand by building big flagship stores, the very same kind of stores they're closing here? Is that a winning strategy?
To be honest, I have mixed feelings about that. Now, of course, I mean, it's great for the brand and, you know, you make a big impact when you open a store like that in a new city. But it's a very long and tedious way to build a brand and to expand in China, in particular when, you know, maybe some of your competitors have been in this market for many, many years and are expanding much faster.
Well, so that's a really good question, right? Is the Gap late to the party in China? I mean, obviously there's room for growth, but have they missed the big boom?
Well, I wouldn't say that. There have been examples of some brands that, in fact, came a little bit too early and probably failed because consumers weren't yet ready for a slightly more premium mid-market apparel brand. But China now you could almost say it's a global battleground where American brands and Japanese brands and Korean brands are fighting it out with a lot of the local Chinese brands, who are also very good because they've sharpened their teeth being suppliers to the very brands that they're now competing with in China.
Torsten Stocker with the Monitor Group. He's based in Hong Kong, also out of Shanghai. We got him in Hong Kong. Torsten, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Here we are in what pretty much everybody agrees is a jobless recovery, right? What pretty much nobody in Washington agrees on, though, is what to do about it. President Obama's jobs bill was blocked in the Senate. Republicans are offering their own plan. It's enough to make you wish there was some automated way to decide it. Robots, maybe. Commentator Farhad Manju says, prepare for the rise of the machines.
A few months ago, I came face to face with my nemesis, software that can write news stories. Right now, the software, made by a firm called Automated Insights, is quite rudimentary. It can only write sports stories, and only stories involving lots of data. The software scans through all the stats from a game and then looks at a huge database of phrases to come up with the perfect words to match the numbers. The end result is a narrative that sounds a bit rote. J.J. Hardy got his 30th home run of the season, and Robert Andino smacked a game-winning single in the ninth as the Red Sox fell to Baltimore 4-3. But it's still perfectly serviceable, and as computers get faster, the robot's work will keep improving. I'm always on the lookout for the next great disruptive invention. Now I've found one that could put me out of work. People have been fretting about machines taking over human jobs ever since the days of the Luddites. Economists scoff at this idea. Technology sometimes replaces workers in the short run, but in the long run it spurs economic growth. And economic growth improves prospects for workers across a range of industries. But this time could be different. Artificial intelligence machines are getting so good, so fast, that they're poised to replace human workers across a wide range of industries. Ironically, it's high-skilled work that's most vulnerable to automation. That's because low-wage workers usually do physical jobs that robots can't yet do very well. In my research, I found many machines that will soon barge into areas of the economy that we'd never suspected possible. They'll be diagnosing your diseases, dispensing your medicine, handling your lawsuits, and they'll be making fundamental discoveries in science. So far, most economists aren't taking these worries very seriously. The idea that computers might significantly disrupt human labor markets is considered to be on the fringes. But it shouldn't be. The robots are coming. We can't defeat them. But maybe we can find a way to coexist.
Farhad Manju covers technology for Slate. Share your thoughts with us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note to wrap things up of a Friday, some news that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Patty Hirsch, senior editor at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
In America, we're actually giving birth to fewer babies.
Really?
Yeah, because of the economy. It seems that Americans gave birth to 4.3 million babies in 2007, right, just before the recession kicked in.
Totally bad timing. They're probably unemployed, right?
Well, you'd hope that the babies are unemployed. And but since then, our birth rate has dropped. This year, last year, it was down to 4 million only.
But doesn't it follow that if the economy's down, then people aren't working, which means they have more time for, you know...
Yeah, I mean, I think you're so stressed out when you're unemployed, or the economy's so stressful that you have fewer kids. I mean, it's the absolute reverse of a baby boom.
It's a baby not tonight.
Millie Jefferson, director, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Reuters has a story this week about a golf course in Brisbane, Australia that has a special kind of wildlife in the waters along the greens.
This is the water hazard?
It's a big hazard because it's sharks.
Like Jaws shark?
Yeah, like a local river flooded the golf course, and when the waters receded...
It left sharks on the golf course?
Exactly. They can do one of two things. It'll be a really awesome reality TV show with people fishing balls out of the lake, or they can throw sharks on the Barbie.
Matt Berger, digital director for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The New York Times did a review this weekend for a $6,400 toilet.
And they wonder why people are occupying Wall Street.
Well, anyway, for $6,400, it's got a heated seat, it's got a blow dryer, it's got music, it's got a remote control. The seat raises and lowers automatically with a little beam of light.
Wait, so this is basically has a computer in it.
Exactly.
What happens if the computer crashes?
Yeah,
without a paddle.
Oh, yeah. There is plenty more where that came from. The podcast Rico and Brendan do is called Dinner Party Download. There's a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow was up 166 points, added nearly 1.5%. The NASDAQ rose 47 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 advanced 20 points, 1.75%, ended at 1224. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. A word now about our senior producer, Celeste Wesson. She has been producing this program for 8 years. Today is the last under her careful ear as she moves on to a different job here at Marketplace, because it's a draining thing running a daily news program. So as she steps back from the grind, a thanks from all of us and from me. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager of Marketplace Enterprises. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. You know, Occupy Wall Street has a lot of support among Wall Street insiders, too.
We bailed out Wall Street to avoid depression, but 3 years later, millions of Americans are in a living hell.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll be back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.